the fan. On demand. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca. Sign up to automatically receive the latest reports, features, and Fan 590 show highlights. It's not a good morning. It's the best morning in sports radio. You're listening to Brady and Lang on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
1-2 pitch so far is strike three call. Wong with a pretty breaking ball punches him out for his second strikeout of the inning and fourth of the game.
Well, he's strong. You know, he's very confident. He's had a lot of success in the big leagues. So that's, you can't rattle a guy. And he played in New York City, you know, the toughest place to play. So, yeah, it's I tip my hat to the guy.
Hey, Wang, what's with the pictures? It's a parking lot. Come on, we in.
A lot of hat tipping in John Gibbons' world. Also, the Texas Rangers, I want you to know, play a great brand of baseball. It's a brand of baseball that they play, and it's pretty damn good. Good brand of baseball. Not so good on the weekend. Blue Jays with a four-game sweep of Texas. The Rangers have lost six straight now. And if the Blue Jays can just get that home record together, look out. Well, they're going to get their chance. They're home for the next 7 nights. And, of course, the days, counting next Saturday. It's Brady and Lang, by the way. Greg Brady, Jim Lang, Mike Farwell. Three things we'll get to before 7:15 this morning. Well, we'll give you Blue Jays Orioles tickets for a upcoming game this coming weekend. The San Antonio Spurs, how favored are they now to win the NBA title? They're going to have to do it on their home, on their road floor, in their road blacks. And NHL Game 3 tonight, Blackhawks and Boston. Who's got the edge? So we have a lot to get to. But we start with the Blue Jays. Great combination, timely hitting, hot bats, especially Adam Lins. And the pitching. That's maybe the most impressive thing to me, guys, about this weekend is they didn't have to go to extra innings to do it. They didn't have to win 9-8 ball games. They outscored Texas this weekend by a count of, when you add up the numbers, by a count of 22 runs, or I've got this wrong, 24 runs, I should say, to 4. None of the games close. They didn't exhaust the bullpen, and Burley, Dickey, Wong, all in a row, after Esmail Rogers started off, were fantastic.
The four starters allowed two runs, earned runs in the weekend. That's just an improbable sight to see after the way they struggled so bad in April. It's an incredible turnaround, Greg. And for Chin-Ming Wong, he's been a revelation, being dropped out of nowhere into the rotation, giving them a start like that.
And look at two of those four pitchers as part of that sweep of the Rangers. As Greg mentions, Esmail Rogers, and you just talked about Chin-Ming Wong. You expect to get what you got from R.A. Dickey and Mark Burley, but to get those starts from Rogers and Wong as part of that four-game sweep of the Rangers is terrific. And now you look ahead with the Rockies coming into town, and you're able to throw Johnson at them tonight. You're able to throw, I think, as Dickey comes up later.
That's a guy
who
hasn't won yet, though.
Johnson.
So is it good to throw Johnson at them?
Absolutely. You got to throw a Johnson in there, don't you?
With a Wong and a Dickey?
Why does he have to win?
Yeah. Yeah, Steve Simmons made that joke about 15 days late, but that's not shocking.
I use Johnson as in reference to one of those guys.
Sorry, so I know it's your favorite columnist, Jim. Anyway.
I like Steve. Yeah.
But you've got Johnson as one of those guys that was expected
funny,
to be a linchpin this rotation.
You're saying it's got to get good. You got to keep getting him out there. It's got to get going sooner or later. You're doing this with Brandon Morrow on the disabled list as well. That's a factor no one's talking about.
And everybody else is pulling their weight now in the rotation. Guys who are expected like Burley and Dickey, guys who came out of nowhere. So now it's up to Johnson going into a contract year to be that kind of pitcher.
I thought Greg Zahn was trading all these players on Wednesday of last week. What happened to the trades?
You guys forget you turned so quickly. Johnson's first start back from the DL was excellent.
He was very good.
And then the next one, not so much. But, okay, so let's put that one behind us and come in tonight and say, okay, let's get back out there and win one for the Gipper.
It's still way more likely Josh Johnson's going to be a factor winning games than Chin-Ming Wong or Esmail Rogers.
100%.
I'm sorry. Like, anyone who's trying to suggest that somehow these guys have become indispensable parts of the rotation after a couple spot starts that they've succeeded in, and but at the same time, here come the Johnson trades, the Johnson trade soldiers again. What do you do within the next 6-7 weeks? This guy has to pitch better for him to be an asset that you're ready to move. But if you slide in there and he's valuable and you're a game out of the wild card, what do you do? Do you ride it out? They didn't trade A.J. Burnett in his contract year, and that team wasn't going anywhere near the postseason.
But you get a couple more quality starts from Chin-Ming Wong and Esmail Rogers, and Brandon Morrow comes back.
Well, good luck.
Then the idea of trading Josh Johnson at the deadline to get something in return, you can stomach that a little more because you have you know you have some pitchers to fill the void if you deal them.
It's true, but this was a little bit of fool's gold. You're not going to – I mean, they limited the Texas Rangers to 4 runs in 4 games. How is that going to happen? How often are you going to get starting pitching 4 days in a row like this, right? You're going to have hiccups and you're going to have burps. It did move the Blue Jays from 29th in ERA in the major leagues all the way up to 22nd in 1 weekend. It's all it takes. You shoot past teams like Philadelphia, Cleveland, Milwaukee, the Angels, who are flirting right around the bottom anyway. Your rotation right now is better than Tampa's, and it's better than Baltimore's. Baltimore's winning games with their bats. You got 3 guys in Chris Davis, Adam Jones, Manny Machado, that probably you'd rather have than any Blue Jays position player outside of Adam Lind right now.
And that's the test. That's when we're really going to know about how the rotation is setting up, because right now it's Dickey, Wong, and Johnson for the 3-game series at Rogers Center against the Orioles. And as you said, the way they're hitting, if you can limit them offensively, then you know you're doing something.
So you got to squeeze by this. I think the Rockies will get kind of unheralded coming in, but they can hit well. They've got some real professional ball players on this team. They don't. De La Rosa's just gutted out a lot of big pitching results this year, got a 3.49 ERA. You'd have to give him the check mark. Carlos Gonzalez has had a great season. They've got Tulowitzki injured right now. But this is not exactly a walkover where you're going to show up tonight and win 2 out of 3 games between now and Wednesday.
I think the Jays are probably just glad they don't have to face Tulowitzki, considering everything else they got to deal with.
So Game 3 tonight, Blackhawks-Bruins, it is certainly getting great ratings in the States. It was going to anyway. Many thought even Chicago-Boston would outdraw Chicago-Pittsburgh, despite the Crosby star status thing, because Boston's a team that people saw 2 years ago in the finals. Boston-Vancouver actually got very good numbers. But the numbers they're getting now are dwarfing this. It's a series that hasn't had a blowout yet. I got to think at some point it'll have one. We're going to have a game that ends 4-0. We're going to have a game that ends, 5-1 at some point in time. We're not going to have 7 overtime games, let's put it that way.
I can't see a big blowout the way these 2 goaltenders are playing.
Well, 3-goal win's a blowout.
Yeah, 3-goal win is a blowout. This is going to be all 1-goal wins from here on in. Whoever wins, whether it's regulation or overtime, they're just that close, these 2 teams. That's the kind of hockey. I think that's what's made it so compelling, is every goal and every mistake is so magnified because there's so little to choose.
I don't think we're going to see a huge margin of victory for either team in this series, too. I know series tend to go that way, and this one looks every bit like it's going to go longer. So over the course of 6 or 7 games, will you see, it's much more likely
Boston
you will
win
three straight. Why can't they? They can win 3 straight. So it's not a 6-game series, then, is what you're saying. Sure, they can. These teams seem so evenly matched through 2. Boston, yeah, headed back home. They can put together back-to-back wins and try to finish it off in Chicago in 5, but I don't see it. I don't just see it going that way. The teams are they're too evenly matched.
So what's the better advantage right now, to have the next 3 of the next 5 home games, or is it having the game 7 at home no matter what? The Blackhawks, no matter what. All they got to do is win 2 of the next 4. It doesn't matter in what arena. And they'll end up being game 7 at home at the United Center.
Game 7 at home, because this thing has every indication it's going 7.
Well, why? I'm asking. I don't know.
Because
I expected to end before 7.
The way this series, Boston got the split in Chicago.
Yeah.
I have no reason to believe Chicago won't get a split in Boston. That's why it's going to end up going 7 games.
I just think law of averages would dictate that you won't, go win one, lose one. Someone will win 2 in a row in this series. Could be tonight. Could be Chicago winning tonight. It could be Chicago winning game 4 and 5 in a row. Someone will have a chance, we know by mathematics, to close out game 6. The question is, are they healthy enough? Do they get off to a good enough start? What are the factors involved with it? I don't think it's going to go 7 games.
Fair enough. Chicago's big concern is it's a game 3 tonight, and they haven't won a game 3 in the first 3 rounds of the playoffs, and that's sort of hung over them, that game 3 is... They not only do they lose, some of the games they haven't played well at all.
Do you think they think about that, though? I don't know if they even remember playing the Wild in game 3. It's all probably a blur. Right?
We do. They don't.
Yeah. All right. So San Antonio wins their game last night, 114-104 over Miami. Honestly, I would not take, if I'd bet on Miami to win this, I would not take the money back. I still feel like they've got the 2 home games, and that's still a big edge. To be honest, the Heat are still favored to end up winning the series on willhill.com. They're still a better bet right now, money-wise, than San Antonio is, because they've got the 2 games at home still, even though San Antonio is 1 game away.
But isn't Popovich almost getting into Spoelstra's head by fielding the kind of starting lineup he does, almost forcing him to bench Anderson? So the Birdman doesn't even get in the game because of the type of lineup that Popovich is putting out there. And the way Danny Green is shooting – They're focusing so much on stopping Parker, Ginobili, and Duncan that Green is getting all these looks to shoot all those three-point shots.
Yeah, it was reasonable. I mean, if you're holding Tim Duncan to 17 points, you've got a much better chance to win than otherwise. Parker's been more of a factor, though, that the hamstring. We talked to Peter Vesey about it last week, and he said if the hamstring's bad, it's bad news for Santoni. He's obviously healthy, or he's gutting through it one way or the other. And then to start Manu Ginobili was a masterstroke last night. It wasn't something I was expecting. Many people were expecting. But he gets the first start of the season last night, gets early minutes, and goes from a dreadful Game 4 performance to what he does last night. I mean, at home, his own fans, reading some of the reports before the game yesterday, the fans were calling on Popovich to take Ginobili out of the game because he was hurting their chances. There's a guy that's done nothing but win for them. Three rings, right? 11 years. He's been one of the best foreign players in the league's history. And they're going, get him out of there. He's killing us right now.
And you watch the way he competes in a game like last night, not just the 24 points, the 10 assists. He was plus 19. He almost had the perfect game in a situation like that in a lot of ways.
You look at the points that Mike Miller put up for the Heat. I think it was game number 4. And you're looking at Spoelstra saying, nice move by you, coach. And then Popovich here with Ginobili to start. As you mentioned, Greg, it looks like a master stroke from last night. Real interesting chess match going on between these guys.
And I don't know what you do if you're Miami with Mike Miller, because he didn't take shots. We mentioned earlier just the 1 3-point attempt. He's not in there for his defense. He did have 5 rebounds in 24 minutes. I mean, you know, extrapolate that out, and it's a pretty good game rebound-wise, but you're not going to play him much more than 24-25 you're playing him. All right, we got tickets to give away for the Blue Jays and Orioles Friday night when Baltimore and Chris Davis and Adam Jones come to town. It's brought to you by Tom's Place, 190 Baldwin Street in Kensington Market. We want the current Rockies player that holds the franchise record for triples. Our call screeners want to be busy for the next hour or so. You're not doing the Jerry Lewis muscular dystrophy telethon. You're answering one trivia question, but the phones are going to be as busy. I'm warning you. No one's getting this early on. The current Rockies player with the franchise record for triples in his career. Scott Morrison next. His thoughts on, well, Game 3, Alain Vigneault to New York, an entire franchise to Seattle.
Now, more of Brady and Lang on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
Brandon Bowling couldn't get the puck out. Sagan, reply, Paye scores! Dan Paye from Tyler Sagan, and the Bruins have tied the series 1-1.
On our side, anyways, we knew we didn't have enough shots, and we wanted to get them through, and it seemed like there was no defense in that zone. Goalies played great, and it was good to finish it off in that period and not to continue on with another one.
Welland, Ontario's Daniel Paye, former Guelph Storm and a championship winner as well, with that excellent Guelph Storm team that had Cam Jansen, Kevin Kline on, a few other future NHLers. Congrats to Vincent Herbert.
And Richmond Hill.
All right. Herb and Richmond Hill knew Dexter Fowler, and he was the first caller, so I was dead wrong about that. Like everything else this morning. Dexter Fowler, 52 career triples and 2,420 plate appearances since his rookie year in 2008. So he holds the current Rockies record for triples. Let's do sack flies tomorrow, Nico, our intern. Golly, jeez.
Poor kid is still reeling from the loss Saturday. Like, be nicer to him.
Why make the show a harder listen than it already is, to be perfectly honest? By the way, you know, and there's Sabres fans now cursing, trading Paye. They moved him for a third-round pick in 2010 that turned into a gentleman named Kevin Sunder. But the Buffalo Sabres just, they drafted Paye 20th, starred a junior, had a 35-point season, then a 27-point season, and then somehow wore his welcome with Lindy Ruff. It happens. And Boston got him for a song and dance, and Sabres look and go, we need more players like, I don't know, that guy. That first-round pick we turned into a third-round pick that hasn't played yet.
And even beyond the goal Saturday, he's become such a key part of that team in the fourth and third line, and Julian can move him in different spots. He's just a dynamite little hockey player. I don't know what Buffalo was thinking.
He's got a great skill set. Little, eh? Six foot and a half? You got heavy standards.
I'm looking at Char and Lucic. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
He's not looking at me. We know that much.
Scott Morrison joins us now, our hockey insider for V-Lux Skylights in advance of Game 3 tonight. Also noteworthy, Scott, they score that goal in overtime with Duncan, Keith, and Brent Seabrook on the ice. And that's something teams have struggled with. That's a great pairing to get an overtime goal from basically your third and a half line against that pairing. Sign of good things to come for Boston.
Yeah, there's no question about that. And, You know, from the Chicago perspective, Seabrook wrapped it around the boards and Bullock lost control of it at the blue line, and they made a quick, good play at the blue line to get it back in, and a quick play by Sagan into the slot and a one-timer, and it's over just like that. So we've seen, in the first two games of the series that the role players have had an impact on both sides.
Scott, after total domination by the Blackhawks in the first period, was this a case of the Bruins physically wearing them down with all the body checks to be able to turn the momentum in that game?
Well, it certainly got them back in the game, Jim. I mean, there's no question about it. And, Chicago was absolutely so dominant through that first period and the early part of the second period. And yet, when you looked at the stat sheet, Chicago had virtually no hits, and Boston had a ton of them. And it was only because they didn't have the puck. And so the good thing, I guess, from their perspective, looking at their game, is that they were at least punishing the Blackhawks. When you made the play, you paid for making the play, and Tuukka Rask kept them in the game and not allowing that next goal that would have been a devastating one. And obviously they had the close call on the Taze Hossa wraparound that almost made it 2-0. So I think the hitting got the Bruins back in the game. They found their legs, and away they went after that. And, of course, you had the marathon game one. And from Chicago's side of it, even though both teams had to recover from that marathon, when you go back to Chicago's wrap-up game against the LA Kings, they've been involved in 15 periods of hockey through those first three games.
Scott Morrison joining us for VLUX Skylights was in Chicago over the weekend for games 1 and 2. I find it hard to really hammer Jaromir Jagr. It's with great responsibility, great expectations follow, and I'd say they're there for a guy like Jonathan Toews, but I don't know what I'd want Jagr to be doing differently. He is near the puck. He looks to be giving effort. I'm not making excuses for his age, but he hasn't scored yet, and I'm shocked. I just feel like the slump's got to end sooner or later because he's in on a lot, isn't he?
No, absolutely. The one thing about it is it's not that he's playing poorly.
Yeah.
And it's the same sort of deal with Tyler Seguin, who had a big impact in game two, is that he's not putting up the goals, but it's not that he's not involved, and it's not that he's not creating chances, that type of thing. He's just been a little bit snake-bitten. And in the case of Jagr is that he's played a big body game for him. He's worked hard. He's used his size and won some battles on the wall and done that sort of thing. He's just not put it in the back of the net. And so, it's one of those things you look at him and you say, it's going to come, it's going to come, and eventually it will. And as I say, it's not a lack of effort or anything like that. So I know Claude Julien has looked at it, and a lot of people said, why not drop him down on the roster, and they did do some movement in some of their lines on Saturday night. But he's also, and Nick Kiprios talked about it in our post-game show on Saturday, he's a difficult player to play with because he likes to have the puck a lot, and so it takes an adjustment for his line mates to get in sync with him as well. So that's another factor in all of that.
How do the Bruins carry over the momentum of that victory from Game 2 into Game 3 tonight?
Well, I guess they need to, obviously it's going to be an energized building, and so you build off your fans and you try and get some pressure. I mean, both games in Chicago, the Hawks were the best team out of the gate, and then in the first game it was only through the first 5-6 minutes that they came out with the crashing and banging. They kept the fans in the game, and then Boston just sort of quietly took over that first period, and then Chicago really found themselves over the next two periods, and Boston's been the better team through the overtimes in both nights, and obviously the other night they were horrible in that first period. There was nobody that showed up other than Tuukka Rask in Game 2, and then they found their game, as we talked about, chipped away to get back in it. So they're going to need a stronger start and build off that energy, as I say, that's going to be in that building tonight.
Before you go, Scott, CBC, I had a report about the Coyotes potentially going to Seattle. How much buzz in Chicago about that, and what do you make of the concept that they'll play out of Key Arena potentially even next year? So basically get this all done within a few months. Don't need to realign. They're still in the Western Conference, and this sort of leaves Quebec waiting for either another move or an expansion franchise.
Well, Greg, there's 11,000 seats in that arena, so you're going to want to get your check in first thing this morning to make sure you get your season tickets because there won't be a lot available. Gary Bettman and Bill Daly had the press conference the other day prior to the series and talked about the situation there, and it is getting to a point of no return. Whether that's a viable option, it's only a viable option if, A, if the owners have the money to pony up to the degree that the NHL wants, and to pay over $200 million for it just seems to be an absurd number to me. And then you're going to need a new arena there. So there's a lot of pieces that have to come into play, and there's still, I guess, another chapter to play out in Glendale City Hall, City Council, to see whether or not they are willing to play ball with the people who are still trying to keep it in Glendale. So it's an option, but it's just another chapter in a story that refuses to end.
Yeah, that makes the Stampede Corral look like, you know, those soccer stadiums in Brazil. I mean, size-wise, right? No, they're shoehorning 7,000 in when Atlanta moved to Calgary, right?
You remember the Stampede Corral with the 6-foot boards there that players couldn't jump over. So. Well, I don't know what the inside of that Key West looks like, but the only Key West I want to go to is down in Florida.
Well, it's a matter of time. July 5th can't come soon enough for all of us. Thanks for this, Scotty. We appreciate it.
Okay, guys. Take care.
Scott Morrison joining us. Was in Chicago. Chicago, Illinois over the weekend, joining us for V-Lux Skylights this morning. We didn't get to a Alain Vigneault, but nothing. I mean, they say what you want about Glenn Sather, doing this, doing that, all the rumors about Mark Messier, but if you snap up a Alain Vigneault to coach, you're probably doing a very good thing for your franchise in the next few years.
And if the perception was that Tortorella was a problem, his personality and his style, you're getting the perfect 180 in Alain Vigneault.
But Vancouver's going to get that with Tortorella.
It's so amazing.
That's good.
But is it? Is that, you know, I can't wait
I
for Canucks Corner next season.
No, yeah, for the Rangers,
the best of torts.
For the Rangers, Vigneault, to me, is the perfect hire right now. He's got the track record, the respect in the league. He's viewed as the anti-Tortorella.
So would you not hire Tortorella if you were Mike Gillis?
But I don't know what the other options are.
You're a broadcaster. You're treating this like a broadcaster. John Shorthouse might not want him to be hired. That's it. He's not making that call.
He's interviewed Lindy Ruff.
And God.
Well, Why do you want Tortorella?
No, this is the problem. I'm laying it out.
If you're Mike Gillis, for fun. Okay. That's what we hire coaches for.
I think he's gotten a lot out of the Rangers. I'm sorry. No one else was getting this out of the Rangers before he got there.
But could he do the same to the Canucks when he got out of the Rangers? Does he have the consistent goaltending with Lundqvist that he will have it? Will he have that in Vancouver? And who will Schneider be?
Well,
it'll
have to be Schneider. That's the big thing. They're now to the point where you're probably again, this Luongo thing's taken such a back seat because the playoffs came and Vancouver got eliminated. We talked about it for a day or two, but it's still going to be, to me, the hockey story of the summer. There's not even a Parise suitor free agent that will trump whatever happens with Luongo and how that shifts balance of power in the league.
But think about Vigneault. He's going to a team. He doesn't have to worry about goaltending from night to night. It's all set.
No, he
knows what he has.
Good luck getting Martin Barron on the show again.
I didn't say he's not the back. Oh, yeah. So Barron's going to take a look for shot.
Barron, Sagan, you're just carving them all out this morning.
Poor Sagan. Hey, what a great setup on that OT winner. Oh, he's not doing enough.
Yeah.
Well, and what about Jágr? You don't think he's done anything at all? You think he should be left in the equipment bag?
Just there's a guy that needs to do more.
You would have been great the morning after Game 6 of the World Series in 93 to do. You know, who the Blue Jays need more from? Joe Carter. I mean, that 3-run homer was nice. But what else has he done? Paul Henderson.
Zero.
My God. I mean, where's Paul Henderson in the first and second periods of games
Zero
5-8?
Goals.
He's a
for
ghost.
Jágr. Zero. Zero. In the playoffs, not just this series, the playoffs. None.
Listen,
zero.
Neil
Zilch.
Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin. I didn't see them on the subsequent moon landings. They were only in on the first one. What have they ever accomplished?
And Jágr was with them on that space shuttle, too.
Yeah, he's old enough for sure.
That's right. That's my point. I'm glad you picked up on it, though.
So, anyway, Jack Adams. Now, you guys want to know this.
Oh, stop. Do we have to go to break?
Seventh place finish for Randy Carlyle and the Jack Adams. Some people here wanted to put him in the top three.
The voters should be ashamed.
You guys wanted him to be a nominee.
Settle down.
Voters should be ashamed for seventh place for Carlyle.
Who else had the kind of improvement points-wise that the Leafs had? They gave him seventh.
The number of things that we get credit for from Greg Brady, it's unbelievable that we wanted Randy Carlyle to win.
You know what I hear all the time, Mike, going around my daily life? I hear, you know, I love the show. Greg Brady's awesome. Why can't Greg be nicer to Randy Carlyle, Jim? Why does he have to be so mean to Randy? Coach Carlyle's done a great job with the Leafs.
People ask Randy why I can't be nicer to you guys. And there's never, Randy never, I don't listen. I don't even know that show exists. I was only on once during the season and it was awful. So, no, the Leafs moved from 13th to 5th place. In the East.
I don't care what the voters said.
How
the Leafs Nation knows what Carlyle.
What? No, honestly, what did Ottawa do in the regular season?
If If Paul MacLean had not won,
and they went from 8th to 7th, what's the higher charting? What on the chum chart, what gets the bullet? 13 to 5 or 8 to 7?
Who had more injuries to their star players, Ottawa or Toronto?
My head already hurts.
You got a migraine already.
Oh, my goodness. You're unbelievable.
They just voted for MacLean because they called him the pesky walrus, the husky walrus. That's why you got the
bug-eyed walrus. The fat bug-eyed walrus.
You guys and your Senators' injuries, the Leafs had some bumps and bruises during the season. And
like Spezza and Carlson and Anderson?
Don't you remember when Reimer was hurt? Lupul's injuries? Come on. Lupul is Mahalik, isn't he? He's better than Mahalik.
He's much better than Mahalik. One more day.
Jake Gardner was so mentally injured he couldn't get in the lineup, thanks to Randy Carlyle.
Mean to Randy.
7:35, it's Brady and Lang. Coming up, Ian Leggett, co-host of The Golf Show. Phil Mickelson, unfairly castigated, or is he a big boy? And he deserves it, and he should have won yesterday. We'll ask Ian next. It's Brady and Lang on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Now, more of Brady and Lang on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
So Justin Rose is the United States Open champion for 2013. And heartbreak again for Phil Mickelson.
Phil Mickelson, a second-place tie. Now 23 top five finishes, and the victory goes to Justin Rose. First by an Englishman since 96, I should say, when Nick Faldo caught Greg Norman, and then some at the Masters. Great thing about Marion. Now, not everyone's a fan of Rick Riley and his writings and his arrogance and whatnot. I get that. But he wrote a great story about how tiny this course is and how tiny the clubhouse is. And he quoted Mike Weir in it. Weir's quote, this was on Friday this happened. I'm sitting there eating breakfast this morning with some guy's kid. He was sitting on the couch eating, oblivious to us even being there. Their dogs are running around. The guy's wife is coming in and out. We're watching SportsCenter, and the kid changes over to the Cartoon Network. I start to say, hey, wait a minute, kid. And then I realize this is his house. So the hospitality centers are the houses near the course where the players can go and have some time before their round, slightly after their round. Goes to the Cartoon Network.
And the first tee box was maybe 2 or 3 yards away from the veranda on the clubhouse. So you could be sitting there having a pint, and you could almost reach out and touch the golfer as he tees off a number one.
Yeah, Riley noted they interviewed Tiger Woods on Thursday in some guy's backyard. They basically just commandeered the yard. He didn't make it all the way back to the course, and that's where Tiger was. Ian Leggett's joining us, of course, co-host of The Golf Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Saturday morning 7 to 8 with Scott Metcalf. And it's really remarkable. And I don't know if you found all the Mickelson angst and the coverage of it afterwards was a bit too much. Like, this is a guy that's never won on the tour or anything, but I don't know. Was Phil more the story, or was it Justin Rose going to get it to you?
Well, I think it almost kind of felt like a little bit like the British Open that year when Tom Watson had a chance to win, and all of a sudden Stuart Sink it's like he didn't even play in the golf tournament. So it's like he ended up winning that tournament. There wasn't a person in the world, and that probably included Stuart Sink after winning, that didn't want Tom Watson to win that British Open. That's almost what, you know, they were trying to get across yesterday in the broadcast, when they should realize that Justin Rose, this is his first step to winning multiple majors, and the path this guy's been on, they should be giving him a little bit more credit for winning than it is for Phil Mickelson handing it over.
Well, let's give him some credit, Ian. What did Justin Rose do right yesterday to pick up that first major?
Well, he just played solid golf all day long. He didn't really get himself into a whole lot of trouble. He drove the ball beautifully. That drive he hit on 18 was just phenomenal. And, you know, he just stuck with his game plan. And you talk about all the, you know, great work and the effort that Sean Foley and he has put in together over the years. But, you know, Justin Rose wasn't that player a few years ago. He was struggling, and even a missing link for him over the last couple of years has been his putting. He's shown up once in a while, and he's been able to grab a win here and there. But this guy works harder than anybody on the planet. I mean, he is, you know, Vijay Singh type of a practice ethic, and I think kudos to him for digging through it and getting his entire game in shape for this week.
Ian Leggett, kind enough to join us. Now, yeah, that number for Rose, we were talking earlier, and I think Rose is not going to be a one major and done type guy. There have been so many of them lately, but you look at guys that have won maybe 3 or 4. He's got the talent of a Payne Stewart. He's got the talent of a Nick Price. I mean, these are big names we're talking about here. A Cabrera. But I don't think too many people doubt Rose, where he's at his age, just 32, is going to win more.
Yeah, I think it would be disappointing to him, especially if he doesn't win more majors going forward. And he's got that mentality. It's not like, you know, okay, I've done it. It's, you know, I've kind of wandered off and, you know, put it in the back burner that I'm a major champion, you know, kind of a Sean McKeel kind of a guy. He's not like that. This guy's going to be around for a long time. He continues to work hard on his game and improve different facets of that, of his whole attitude toward the game. And he's just going to get better and better.
Why was it for a course, as Greg alluded to, so tiny and so short by modern PGA standards, so difficult for the best in the world to score on, Ian?
Well, I think it's just set up. I mean, the USGA, that's exactly what they do. They can turn the easiest golf courses in the world into absolute animals. But the interesting part about it is that, you know, ever since Mike Shea has taken over from the USGA in the course setup, the players, they don't sort of take it to the point where this golf course is unplayable. They know that there's quality there. They've got to drive the ball in the fairway. If they, you know, the pin placements aren't exactly ridiculous like they used to be, where we used to, you know, dating back to watching, you know, John Daly whacking it around at Pinehurst because of the frustration level that players used to go through. They're fair, and, you know, they push the gambit to the point where they're trying to find even par as the champion. But at the same time, you're going to see guys go out there, you know, and a handful of them are going to shoot under par on Saturdays and Sundays as the golf course gets tougher and tougher. But that's exactly what they do. They try to set the golf course up to get even par to win, and it's unbelievable how year after year they're able to do that.
We haven't talked much about Tiger Woods this morning. Just such a non-factor on Sunday. Was done so early that the NBC didn't even get a chance to show much of him live. Do we read into any of this going in to the British Open? He did finish fourth at the Masters, so it's, you know, it's not like he isn't getting results in majors. He's won more on tour than anyone else has this year, but he just had a bad weekend.
You know, that's it. I mean, he played poorly at Memorial, and, you know, he's not the Tiger of old. I mean, the thing is, you know, as a comparable to a guy like Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods, Tiger Woods used to be able to win golf tournaments playing at about 60-70% of his capabilities. Mm-hmm. You know, and if he showed up playing at 100%, you know, you got what you got at Pebble Beach that year, and he, you know, won, you know, four, had claimed all four majors at one particular time. So most players on the PGA Tour, they've got to be firing on all four cylinders to be able to claim victory. And Tiger Woods right now, his 60-70% is 60% of what anybody else on the PGA Tour is. When he's at 100%, his 100% is still better than anybody in the world. It's just that he's not able to win golf tournaments playing at, you know, his limited capabilities anymore. He's got to be playing at his best.
Sportsnet's Ian Leggett joining us on Brady and Lang. Thanks for this, Ian. We appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Ian Leggett, 7 to 8, Saturday morning, the golf show, along with Scott Metcalf. So check that out, not just majors weekends, but every weekend the rest of the summer. On fire is a young whippersnapper named Adam Lind, designated for assignment, sent to the minors by the Blue Jays last season in May, and he's rebounded this year. Doesn't even have the requisite number of at-bats to show up for qualifying for the AL batting title. But he has been just lighting it up in May and early June. Now hitting .350, 2 percentage points behind Miguel Cabrera. Now slugging at .561. He's got a ways to go to get to where Cabrera is. But it's been more the average numbers that have just been downright shocking for Adam Lind. We were trying to think about, for, you know, a guy who's a 270 career hitter. He's hitting 80 points above his average. He's had a couple good seasons and an all-star year in 09. Trying to think of the last Toronto athlete that was just looked like on an island. I mean, destined for mediocrity to downright is done, who's bounced back in form like Adam Lind. And I had a really tough time thinking of a Maple Leaf, really tough time thinking of a Raptor that you gave up on. But this is what Adam Lind is now.
The closest comparable I could come up with was Roy Halladay when he burst on the scene and almost had a no-hitter. He looked like the next great thing in the Blue Jays rotation. And then his form is, his whole delivery went to hell, and they had to send him to A-ball to rebuild him from the ground up. Then he became unstoppable.
Yeah, there's so many Maple Leafs players who, you know, obviously, I always think of the young defensemen, right? The Richardsons and whatnot. Even the Iafrates, though he was injury ravaged near the end of his career, still played over a decade. And you think about those guys, but they didn't really, maybe if they didn't become what you thought they were going to become, they certainly didn't while they were in Toronto. Like they go,
Craig Muni,
not quite that level. But as a Richardson, but yeah, they go somewhere else, are steady. Jason Smith's one I'd say.
Yeah.
And they can play. Whereas you'd be like, just get them out of here and that's the end of them, and then we'll move on from there. But I can't think of a guy who the team kept in Toronto, stayed consistent, and then all of a sudden star. Seemingly, you know, like we'll see. We'll see what the All-Star game's like. He should make it. I can't see a scenario where he would be snubbed, but it would also potentially take the spot of an Edwin Encarnacion. I don't know if Bautista will be an All-Star this year, and I'm not saying that to be insulting. I'm just saying there's so many really good outfielders posting really big seasons in the American League this year.
But Lynn's hitting .423 in June. If he keeps it up as they get towards picking the team, he'll be so hot it's difficult to see them not saying, that's the guy we're going to have to take as our Blue Jays representation because he's hitting so well.
But there are odd guys that kind of play out of position. Trumbo's a guy like that, too, who's had a decent season, 15 home runs, but he's only hitting .266. The Angels will send Kendrick. They'll send Trout. But, I mean, there's just so many. There's only so many players you can take. David Ortiz is making a big push at his age to be considered an All-Star this year, and he's a DH.
But he deserves to have some sort of, you know, entry into the All-Star game based on what he's done somewhere.
Good list on Entertainment Weekly. Yesterday being Father's Day. See, it's all flowery and cool and everything. And you know, Justin Rose is a dad, lost his dad. So it ends up being a big story. But Entertainment Weekly put a list together of the worst television dads of all time. And you never want to see yourself reflected in many of these characters. Walter White from Breaking Bad's an obvious one. I haven't watched Dexter since the first couple seasons. I didn't know Dexter was a dad. This is a serial killer. His dad, but he only kills bad people, sort of like a vigilante.
I always view G.R. Ewing as one of the most horrible TV dads of all time.
I don't know. His son got to live in a pretty neat place. They had like a pool with a swim in.
What if not drinking even a diving and womanizing board? And conniving?
But
and
that doesn't affect your dad business,
I guess.
Does it?
What if Dexter's kid becomes a bad person? Then what? Talk about a dilemma.
I mean, would you rather be Tiger Woods' kid, or would you rather be, you know, son of a guy who's, you know, down on his luck and can't find work and, you know, is pinching pennies? And
well, if the guy is pinching pennies, but he's a good dad, I think you don't know money. Yeah,
good luck getting the birthday present you want, right?
They have Al Bundy on this list.
Do you think that's fair?
Al Bundy, he was a good dad.
There's a lot of couch time. Never mind.
He was always there for the kids. He always knew where dad was. He was there in the house.
They would always make an appearance, yeah. Tony Soprano? I mean, this is dad that kills people. Like, if my dad was killing people left and right, I feel like I would know about it. I don't know if would I love many less? No.
But no one bullied the son, though, knowing who the dad was. That's always a good thing to have up your sleeve if you're about to get bullied in school. Your dad's Tony Soprano.
But then the list lists Mike Brady from the Brady Bunch because Robert Reed got in a dispute with producers over money, and he wasn't on the episode where Greg graduated. And I thought, you can't miss your son's high school graduation.
Not even over a contract squabble.
That. No, plus, but think about it also. Mike and Carol were both divorced. I mean, what went wrong in their first marriages? That gets so glossed over in the entire show, right? Like, was Carol running around on the town on her first husband? Was Mike a veritable Ike Turner to get along with? We don't know these things. Did Mike just turn the other cheek? Once he acquired three daughters in this transaction?
They always had lots of station wagons and neat cars in the driveway, too.
Now, underrated, Frank Costanza. Is that a good dad or a bad dad? George's dad.
Great dad.
You think so?
Yeah. Putting up with George? He's a good father of the year.
Might have been the other way around.
Yeah. That's bad. It's bad.
It's not
honestly,
good.
Really bad parents. Susan's parents weren't any better.
I'll take Mr. Costanza over Susan's parents.
7:56, 8 o'clock update on the way. Next hour, Buck Martinez, Eric Smith, and your reaction to 25 years of a pretty seminal sports movie in our culture. 25 years ago yesterday.